Well, good evening, and thanks for tuning into Hemispheres. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and thanks again for tuning into listener-supported community radio, KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, and, of course, at kgnu.org. This evening on Hemispheres, we continue the Middle East dialogues, as always. Joining me in those dialogues are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. Ibrahim Kazrouni, as many of our listeners know, he's a contributor to the International Press Roundtable. Ibrahim also has a PhD from the Joint ILF and Denver University PhD programs within religion and social change concentration. And Ibrahim is also a mom of the Islamic Center of America, which is in Dearborn, Michigan, which is where he's joining us from. And good evening to you, Ibrahim.
Good evening, Jim. Good evening, Rob. And a wonderful evening to our listeners.
And also joining, as I mentioned, is Rob Prince. Rob is retired senior lecturer of international studies at the Corbell School at Denver University. Rob has also published in online magazines such as the Foreign Policy in Focus, AlgeriaWatch.org, and he's also contributing regularly to the award-winning online publication Nahwat.org. It's a Tunisian human rights publication. So, good evening to you, Rob.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Ibrahim. And good evening, listeners.
Well, this evening, we're going to be discussing the it seems like we always come back to the JCPOA in some respect, and it's got a new, and it's got sort of a new life here. Biden has we'll see, but Biden has said he wants to rejoin, but he is like, I don't know, middle of the road Democrats, whatever you call them. Trump actually, pulled out, and he put on the maximum pressure campaign, which was a lot of sanctions, mostly sanctions,
and failed.
And failed, but they're still there. And I mentioned to Rob earlier, it's like we say, oh yeah, we're going to return, but you've got to follow these things before we lift the sanctions or end maximum pressure. And and it implied in there is that, well, they did something like leave the agreement, which they never did, and they always abided by it, and we are the ones that left, and we're saying, well, you got to do this. So, and we also, you know, we're I have to say, you guys will bring me back to reality, but I'm somewhat optimistic that maybe something will happen and we will be able to rejoin the JCPOA. And maybe that will happen. But we did also murder one of their leaders, Soleimani. And I mean, if the shoe were on the other foot, I'm not sure what whether we would be talking at all. So anyway, with that brief little introduction to this evening's program, I would turn it over to you gentlemen, and I'm not sure who's going first this evening.
Jim, I'm going first for a change.
I'm not going to get in the middle of that one.
No, don't. Since you mentioned something, you talked about Qasem Soleimani, if the situation would have been different, I think we would have bombed them out to smithereen.
Well, true.
The fact that they are even contemplating, according to their own condition, to sit at the same table with the United States is a magnanimous gesture by the Iranian towards the United States after 42 years of pain.
I think that's what I was implying there as well. It is. Yeah. It's amazing on their part. Go ahead. Sorry.
The first 100 days of Biden administration is we want to focus a little bit on the first 100 days and to see what the first 100 days so far of it, which normally is only about 30 days or so, has passed since the inauguration. What do they tell us about the foreign policy program of Biden administration? But before we get into that, I thought it would be helpful to look at the how this 100 days has gained a significance as a benchmark to measure the policies of the incoming president. If you look at into the political narratives in the United States, the whole 100 days, first 100 days, has been attributed to President Franklin D. Roosevelt, where on July 24th of 1933, remember, he was sworn in to be 32nd President of the United States on March 4th, 1933. Technically, June 11, 1933 would have been the end of his 100 days. But he gave a speech on July 24th, a radio address. And within that radio address, he coined the phrase or the term of 100 days. And he said, quote, "We all wanted the opportunity of a little quiet thought to examine and assimilate in a mental picture the crowding event of the 100 days which had been devoted to the starting of the wheel of the New Deal." Since Franklin's time, Roosevelt's time, this has gained its unique idea that we look at the first 100 days of an incoming president, and we can broadly make a judgment as a benchmark to exactly which direction the president is going in relation to the promises made during the primary and the electioneering period. That's number one. But some historians claim that the root of the 100 days actually goes way before. The 100 days concept having its roots in France, where the concept of Saint Jour, the 100 days, referred to the period of 1815 between the Napoleon Bonaparte's return to Paris from exile and his final defeat at the Battle of Waterloo and the beginning of the reign of King Louis the 18th, I believe. So that's the original historical origin. But irrespective of whether it had something to do with French or Roosevelt or anybody else, normally what we do, we look at this period to see the direction and how the new president is going to navigate the administration's path through the many promises and the reality of the world politics that he has to deal with. Unfortunately, we are beginning to see, although we have to admit that there is little bit of movement, as you said, Jim, that even today in Washington, I believe the spokesperson for the the State Department, Ned Bryce, he reiterated the 2015 agreement should be the basis, the proper basis of negotiations. So that's a climb down by United States after putting so many preconditions for United States to admit that they are going, they intend, well, at least they recognize first that 2015 is the best, the most profound base that they can go back to, and that Joe Biden does not recognize the strategy chosen by the previous administration vis-a-vis Iran. Saying all this, and that creates hope, but yet United States has put so many preconditions on the side for the Iranians, that they have, and so many loops for them or hoops that they have to jump through it before United States honors them by their presence. Which has what Biden did not expect was the Iranians to remain firm and reject any of these conditions or preconditions. They have repeatedly indicated that they haven't left the 2015. Every step of the way that they have, every action that they have taken has been within the Article 36 of the agreement that permitted and accepted their behavior. Even the head of the IAEA, the IAEA that went to Tehran on Saturday had no other option but to accept that the 2015 agreement, the Section 36 of it clearly had laid the foundation for the Iranians to take the necessary steps that they have taken. Unfortunately, despite everything, a little bit here, a little bit there, we don't see much change. And because we don't see much change, it's troubling for us. That despite all the promises, Biden has not taken the opportunity to move forward very quickly and establish a relationship with Iran regarding this issue. Although there are signs here and there, unsubstantiated, that the United States is asking this country, that country to intervene, Russia or China or somebody else. But at the moment, this is where we stand. And this is why I have to be realistic and say, well, I would like to be hopeful. And yet, all the signs within the 1 month, 30 days, 35 days so far, they are not indicating that huge change is going to take place. Rob, do you want to add something?
Yeah. The record is so mixed at this point. Some of it hopeful, a lot of it not. On the one hand, look, there's a genuine push on a level that I haven't seen for a long time among peace forces, progressive churches, and the like. Really pushing, grassroots movement, pushing the administration to return to the Iran nuclear deal, as is the 2015 deal. And I've mentioned, I think on the last program, that there was a coalition that came together here in Colorado. It calls itself Coloradans for Middle East Diplomacy and Peace. And I want to tell you, I'm really impressed with the work that they've done. It's very serious. And their commitment to getting the United States back into the agreement is unquestionable. They've gotten the support of the Democratic congressional delegation here in Colorado. The two senators say that they're supportive as well. And so this grassroots work, it's there, and it's not just here in Colorado. It's nationwide. On the other hand, when you look at the Middle East policy and the Biden administration's policy since he's come to office, it's troubling in a way. And before zeroing in on Iran, you know, the overall policy is for more military involvement in the Middle East and less diplomacy. And if that's the general case, well, where is Iran going to fit into this? And the real question is whether the United States is serious about returning to the agreement, or is it merely posturing with these latest gestures? I don't know the answer to that, and I think we're going to find out. I hope we're surprised, because I share Ibrahim's skepticism. But I didn't think that things would get this far in a positive way. So who knows? And what I'm seeing from the Biden administration, when I look at it, is a kind of almost a desperation, if you like. There, I have a memory of one of my colleagues at DU, who she used to say, whenever there's two countries say they're not negotiating with each other, they're negotiating with each other, you know, behind the scenes, so to speak. And in this case, in the last few weeks, what I've seen is like almost a furious flurry of U.S. diplomatic activity. Basically, the United States going to different countries, asking them to intervene with Iran, asking through these third parties for some kind of process to take place. So one of the countries involved was Qatar. But the other two countries, and this is rather startling, given the level of of criticism that we hear about Russia and China. But apparently, the administration has gone both to Russia and China and asked Russia and China to intervene on Washington's behalf with Tehran. And that suggests to me that the United States is quite nervous about being isolated on this issue. And it needs to at least give the appearance of some kind of motion. I hope it's
Rob,
more than that. Yes.
Rob, can I interject?
Of course.
You see, you mentioned something. I have seen few, articles or at least references with regard to Russia. But with China, I haven't seen anything to substantiate that. As a matter of fact, as I explained to you,
something. Yeah.
I had a meeting with few of the religious scholars here had a meeting with the new FBI director, and
with the FBI
he mentioned
director?
Something
in Michigan.
Yes,
oh,
yes,
interesting.
In Detroit.
Okay,
in Detroit.
On. Yeah.
So he mentioned something which was interesting. He said that the current administration is focusing its policy from the Middle East towards China as number one concern. And if we were to believe him, which I don't have any doubt, why not? If we were to believe him, I don't believe Biden administration at the same time would try to attempt to undermine China and yet go to China and ask to intervene or somehow become the intermediaries with Iran. Certainly, Russia and China are in very close relationship with Iran, both economically, politically,
right,
militarily. But I don't believe this is on a practical basis is possible. But Russia, I would agree. But Qatar, again, we have ample proof for it because Qatari foreign minister went to Tehran and everything was hush-hush. Nobody talked anything about. But the only thing he left, when he left, he said that we have made our positions clear, and we have reached a consensus, et cetera, and then he departed.
Well, the Russian connection is certainly speculation. However, it has to do with John Kerry speaking to Lavrov, the Russian foreign secretary, supposedly about climate change, which, you know, hopefully they'll do. But the understanding was that probably the question of Iran came up. I don't remember where I saw mention of some kind of connection with China. So I'll check up on that. But the bottom line is still that the United States has been under the surface quite nervous about being isolated on this issue, and this diplomatic momentum. For whatever reason, or with whatever goal, it's real. Now, having said that, if you look at how U.S. policy is shaping up in the rest of the region, what is it that the region being the Middle East? What is it that we're seeing? And this is just in the last month. What we're seeing is a hardening of the U.S. position towards the region, a military hardening. So the first thing the United States announces is not only is it not going to withdraw troops from Iraq, but it's going to build three new military bases in the country, right? And this comes, of course, after the Iraqi parliament itself has called for an end to the U.S. bases. Then both Biden and Blinken have made very clear statements that they're that they will not address the Syrian crisis, as they call it. They're going to let it fester. And now we're seeing in Idlib province, which we've looked at rather carefully over the course of the last year, once again, a rather significant Turkish military buildup into that province. So that doesn't bode well at all.
And by the way, with regard to Syria, yesterday United States moved about 1,000 troops from Iraq into Syria.
Again, not what I would call a sign in the direction of peace, if you like. The Biden administration did not necessarily, the Democrats didn't necessarily support Trump moving the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but they're not doing anything about it either. So we have that. And finally, the big thing, what it looked like might happen towards the end of the Trump administration was coming to an agreement for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. That is on hold. And what we've seen there is that the Taliban have increased their military activity as a result. So we have all that. But we have what is really a more basic issue when it comes to Iran. And that is that how can you negotiate with a country seriously at the same time that you're calling it a threat to peace? And this is really the dilemma that the administration has itself in. It weakens the American argument that they're serious about negotiation. And certainly what it does is it hardens public opinion in the country here against such. Why should we make an agreement if Iran is portrayed as this threat to peace? And we've talked about this also on a number of occasions. I see this as the main ideological barrier to peace, far, far more significant than the technical differences that we're talking about in terms of nuclear energy development in the country.
The difference between United States and Iran is the nuclear issue. Nuclear issue
we're
is the facade.
About that, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So,
chime in? I think and what I've seen on your corporate media, they have all these ex-diplomatic officials, and many of them are talking just like you're saying, Rob and Ibrahim. I mean, they bring up all these bogus old examples like, if they're going to get involved with Iran again in this deal, the missiles that, the ballistic missiles that they have, that's been the bogeyman thing for all the. I mean, like it's sort of like the Republicans bringing up the deficit as an issue for, the 1.9 million. It's like you got to be kidding. You're still bringing that up, but they're bringing
keep moving the goalposts.
Yes,
Jim.
That's correct. And
they keep moving the goalposts. For example, the ballistic missiles weren't raised in 2015. And this is a strategy that the United States has used in many other places when it really doesn't want to negotiate. So the bottom line is, at this point, we're looking at a situation where there is some momentum towards the United States re-entering the agreement, but on the other hand, there's the stuff in the shadows that we're bringing out into the open, if you like, and it's unclear what's going to happen. But Ibrahim, having said that, what would it mean? What would it mean to the region if the United States did return to the JCPOA and if it did abide by the conditions that agreement set out 6 years ago now?
It's a good question. I believe Rob, Jim might remember as well, we have discussed this in one of our previous program, that the preface to the agreement clearly outlines the hope of all the participants that if they were to work together and implement the various parts of this agreement, what will happen? It says, if I may read, they anticipate that the full implementation of this JCPOA will positively contribute to regional and international peace and security. Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapon, and at the same time, others will undertake to remove all the sanctions and help Iran's peaceful nuclear program, including its enrichment activities and to a commercial basis, etc., etc. So the 2015 clearly stipulated what was the intent if the agreement was fully implemented by all parties. The problem was that despite the fact that everybody signed it, and United States signed it as well, I don't believe from what unfolded during the Obama time, immediately after the signing, I don't believe that Obama or U.S. administration thought that it is obligated to do anything as long as Iran is tamed. That's all what they wanted to get from it. But since you ask what will happen, I believe if they were to be implemented properly, then naturally a stable, peaceful environment will exist in the region through collaboration and cooperation, which ultimately leads to stability and peace. And if United States really wanted stability and peace in the region, I think there is no other option, no other option, but for U.S. to go back. The point that were outlined within the 2015 of this JCPOA, whatever agreement, the nuclear agreement. One thing we really need to make clear that even up to today, Iran has not, let me repeat for the benefit of our listeners, Iran has not withdrawn from the 2015.
Right.
It has certainly reduced some of its commitment that Chapter 236 of that agreement permits Iran to do once the other parties fail to honor the agreement and implement its components. So Iran is still remaining within the agreement. And this is the significant part for the debate. Iran has made it clear during the past 2 or 3 days that U.S. by withdrawing from the 2015 is no longer part of the agreement. So the agreement was 5+1, including Iran, etc. Here now, Iran considers it technically is 4+1. So Iran is not prepared to negotiate anything with the United States until the United States comes back to, and accept this. And the spokesperson for the State Department's clearly well, it was a step in the right direction. It's based
right.
on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, a couple things.
No, I wanted to say that.
Go on.
Based on the provision that the agreement permits Iran, the Parliament agreed and stated that if U.S. is not returned to the negotiation table, which means has not accepted 2015, today Iran would withdraw from chapters or sections of the agreement that included the snap visitation, etc., etc. And they did.
There were additional. There were additional stipulations, weren't they? They're not in. They're not part of the Hart Agreement, but they're voluntary.
Voluntary stipulations.
Yes. Okay. Right.
Yes. So Iran
withdrew from that today. Does not mean that Iran is withdrawing.
No, Iran withdrew from that voluntary part today. But at the same time, as Zarif was outlining today, that the visit of IAEA to Tehran has simply given an extension or breathing space. Iran said that according to the parliament instruction, we will withdraw from that voluntary basis today. But yet the data that was that would be collected from now until 3 months will be kept by Iran if United States and others honor the parts and provisions of 2015, then we will hand within 3 months. Then we will hand this data to the IAEA. If not, they will be deleted and destroyed. So Iranians, some people claim that Iranians are posturing. No, they are not. They are serious about their position, and they are not going, as a number of their negotiators have made it clear. The 2015 agreement, without removal of the sanction and allowing Iran full access to the economic, political, and everything else markets in the world, is meaningless. And as so it's just not worth even the ink on a piece of paper. So Iran is quite serious. And they have taken a number of steps to support their position, whether it was opening the nuclear mines or the increasing the enrichment to 20%. And yesterday, Khamenei said something that 20% does not mean its limit. If it's necessary for our whether nuclear positions or nuclear power or anything else, instead of buying stuff from outside that are more concentrated, we can do it ourselves and save huge amount of money. So here is the step, the gradual, as somebody said, in the political sense, the salami tactic. Slowly and slice by slice, they are moving forward. It's upon incumbent upon United States to go back.
I'm going to jump in here just real quick and let the listeners know the time is 6:35 and they're tuned to and this is Hemispheres and the Middle East Dialogues. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and you're tuned to KGNU. And joining me in these discussions, as always, we're listening to Ibrahim Kazrouni and also on the line, Rob Prince. So I just needed to do that. Quick station ID. Go ahead.
Okay. I want to add a couple of things to these points, just elaborate on some of them. One of the points of confusion that comes through the media and the government today, our government, is that that what we're talking about right now is that a reopening of negotiations between the United States and Iran. And that is not the case, all right? Basically, the ball is in the United States court. What the Iranians are saying is, you're out of the agreement. We are in it. If you come back in the agreement, we will negotiate with you once you have accepted the conditions of the agreement. Of course, the big issue, the elephant in the room, is sanctions, as Ibrahim mentioned. So we're not talking about negotiations right now, all right? This is not what's happening. The issue, the really key issue remains, will the United States return to the 2015 agreement or not? And if they do, then there's all kinds of potential. If they don't, it's off. The whole thing is off, so there will not be any negotiations. So that's the first point. The second point that I want to make has to do with what this is all about. And, you know, on a technical level, of course, it has to do with how much uranium the Iranians are enriching, with sanctions. But if you get really deep down beyond that, beyond the technical issue, The real question in these negotiations is, will the United States normalize its relations with Iran? All right? That's really what this is. That's the heart and soul of the JCPOA. And what normalization means, and Ibrahim referred to this to a certain degree, is the beginning of a process where the United States, Iran, actually other places too, Russia, China, the Europeans, that there's an effort to deal with the many other issues that are exacerbated in the Middle East today, be it Yemen, be it the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Syria. So this was what 2015, I remember when that agreement was signed, and at that time, I was at a couple of press conferences, one in which Gary Hart spoke, and Gary Hart spoke in favor of this agreement at the time. And what I asked Gary Hart is, do you see this as the beginning of a thaw, if you like, and of a normalization of ties that moves the whole region in the direction of peace? And I still remember his response. I thought it was a pretty open-ended question, if you like, but it was basically still, we're going to stop the Iranians, we're going to stop the threat. And so that was, you know, that was a little bit disappointing. But when I look at this agreement, this question of, it's the heart and soul, again, is normalization. And for normalization to take place diplomatically, you need to have confidence-building measures. Confidence-building measures are part and parcel of every major international agreement in the last who knows how many years, i.e., both sides tone down the rhetoric. Okay, both sides, you know, try to find the positive in the other side. You have to create a certain environment. And what I notice here is that the United States has not done that with Iran. The United, in fact, if anything, the rhetoric against Iran in the last few months it continues to be this rather shrill negative stuff. And so that concerns me too. Finally, there's something else, and we want to talk about this a little bit more. What is it, when you really look at, if you like, both the Israeli and the Saudi position, what's the issue? Now, you know, supposedly what we're hearing from Netanyahu is, oh, the Iranians are going to build a nuclear bomb, it's going to be a threat to the region. Number of points. Number one, there's no evidence, none, that Iran is building or intends to build a nuclear weapon. But even if that were the case, how many nuclear weapons does Israel have? I mean, you know, I remember 30 years ago when Mordechai Vanunu, the whistleblower, if you like, from the Dimona nuclear plant, and he talked about 200 nuclear weapons that Israel had. Now, whatever the number is, Israel is a nuclear arsenal, and the notion that somehow an Iranian bomb is going to threaten Israel is silly. Beyond that, it's impossible to have a nuclear detonation in the Middle East. The region is too small. It doesn't matter what country the bomb would be detonated in. It would affect the whole entire region. And the more you look at this nuclear issue, all right, it's a false flag. It's false. There's something else that's going on. And what we think is going on is the following. If relations with Iran are normalized, Iran's situation in the region, if it's permitted, the sanctions are taken away, it can deal in the global economy, the Iranian economy is going to take off. And Iran's prestige in the Middle East is going to grow at the expense of Israel and Saudi Arabia. All right? And that is the problem. The problem as we understand it, is to stop the development of the Iranian economy and Iranian influence in the region.
Which is the zero-sum game in politics, Carl.
Sorry? Yes.
Which is the zero-sum game in politics.
Exactly. A zero-sum game. Zero-sum game meaning if Iran wins, the other two lose. Now, again, we're not going to get beyond this issue in Saudi Arabia and Israel for a long time. But if you think about it, it doesn't have to be that way at all. Why does it have to be a zero-sum game? But that's the problem, and it's also the problem for the United States. Why? Because if the United States normalizes its ties with Iran, it will be seen as weak. And it will be seen as weak, and the message that other U.S. allies will get is, well, if this happened with the Iranians, we're going to be able to take advantage of this situation. That is, in my mind, really the issue why the United States is hesitating to go into this agreement. Ibrahim, is that a flaky theory, or
no? As a matter of fact, I totally agree with you. If we read between the lines of the nuclear deal, it clearly stated, and I remember even John Kerry after the signing of that agreement, when he was asked, he said it's a win-win for all, right. Which is all parties compromise and mutually benefit from the agreement. Unfortunately, as you quite correctly indicated, relationship of United States with Iran is not based on facts and figures. It's based on an ontological position, an ideological position that the United States, from the moment that the Iranian revolution succeeded, was not prepared to accept that revolution is going to stay. Everything else in between, 42 years ago up to now, has been based on this animosity and the fact that the United States would do everything possible to see the back of this regime. You will not be able to go beyond maximum pressure that Trump imposed on Iran, and yet it failed. I think Biden, instead of painting itself into a corner or himself into a corner, and putting preconditions, et cetera, that now they have to climb down. And Iranians are not prepared to give them a helping hand, to climb down of this high position that they have taken. Understand that sanctions is not going to work. And a couple of weeks ago, at the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, around the beginning of February, around the beginning of February, when some old papers, British papers, came out, Ambassador Sullivan, the British ambassador in Iran for many years, he stated that I wrote to the American administration, I don't remember which one at the time, and I reminded them, sanction is not going to work with the Iranians, because it hardens their position, they are nationalistic, and they are not prepared to succumb to sanction. And yet, administration after administration stated there, why? Because the relationship with Iran is centered on a unique ideological myopic understanding of the reality. Iran is not going to disappear. We might as well understand it. As the JCPO, the nuclear deal, clearly stated, all parties were hoping that by signing this agreement will some benefit from it. Approaching it with the zero-sum game, which is part of a game theory, particularly once you allow this principle to get into the formation of foreign policy as we have it in the United States, it leads to tension, conflict, and exacerbates the political conflict and tension between various countries, rather than somehow come up with a solution that we can work together for peaceful resolution of the crisis or the regional crisis. Go ahead.
Quickly, I don't know how quickly this answer will be, but my question would be, the Iranians certainly have seen that this is not a treaty, so it is going to be like it was before, a sort of a proclamation. I can't remember, an official treaty would take the Senate to approve it, and I think it needs to be a two-thirds majority to approve a treaty, and so that would probably not happen. And we have another chance if in 4 years a new administration, if it's Republican, would possibly end the deal again. And maybe
that's exactly, Jim, what Ayatollah Khamenei talked about a few weeks ago. He said that and Zarif and every other, as well as Rouhani, that we really don't trust the United States. This is why they want some kind of guarantee, which I think last month we were talking about this point, Rob and I, what kind of guarantee the Iranians can right. have from the United States that this kind of thing is not going to happen in the future. With the way mistrust exists between the Iranians and United States, and I don't blame them, 42 right. years of nothing but pain from the United States, so there is a huge degree of mistrust between the two entities. Iranians are not, they are tiptoeing and wary of any negotiation with the United States. Just remember, 2015, Security Council, all the hullabaloo about it. And then Trump comes in as, who was it that tore the agreement in Second World War? Hitler. Tearing the agreement, Versailles Agreement, between after the First World War, that I don't recognize it. That's it. And we are going back to the same old crisis before. So Iranians are not prepared to enter another deal that, as you indicated, quite possibly 4 years from now, resurrected Trump walks in under a section of the Republican Party and wins the election, even through rigging, as he indicated. So we have now back to square one and the same old story again all over. And so Iranians...
I was just going to say it wouldn't need to be Trump. I mean, they're all pretty much opposed to it. So,
yeah. So anyway, what we really need, following up for what Rob has said, what we need a fundamental change. An outlook change, or what within the United States, that look, Iran is going to be there. We might as well recognize that fact, and let's go back and do business so that everyone within the region wins, rather than only United States and its regional puppets, Saudi Arabia and Israelis or anybody else. So until that happens, a proper 2015 agreement will not be implemented. And Iran is not prepared to accept anything short of that. So we are going back to the under what condition the United States is going to re-enter and what kind of plan it has. Rob, you want to add anything?
Yes, I do. I'm thinking back historically at different moments. When one moment when the United States realized the Soviet Union, at least then, wasn't going to collapse in the 1930s, and that's the beginning of a more business-like approach to the Soviet Union. In the 1970s, Kissinger and Nixon do the same thing with China. Now, of course, part of what they were trying to do is split China off from the Soviet Union, but in both cases, what we saw was kind of realism. These countries are here to stay, and that's what's missing. That kind of attitude, that kind of realism, is missing from the U.S. approach to Iran. They're still trying to overthrow the government. Okay, they're still talking about regime change. In fact, one of the interpretations even of signing the agreement, it's this nonsense, at least in my mind, that we'll sign the agreement, the liberals in Iran will come to power, and the religious leaders will be pushed aside, and they'll have a more Western economic approach. This is utter nonsense. This is lack of realism. So let's see where we're at. on the one hand, it's pretty clear that the United States cannot go to war with Iran because the military balance of power is such that Iran, it's not that Iran would win such a war, but it would be able to hurt U.S. interests in the region very, very badly. So that is out. On the other hand, it doesn't look like, from where both of us are sitting, that the United States is serious about returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. I hope we're wrong. If we're wrong, I'll be the first to admit it, but I doubt that we're wrong. Okay. So where are we then? We're in the same place that we were before Biden got elected. Okay? We're still in a world of maximum pressure and provocation, and that's what's going to continue. That's what's going to continue. And this unstable tension that could lead to all kinds of bad things. And at some point, you have the feeling that it's unsustainable by itself. That something is going to crack. So that's what I see the future as. Ibrahim, how do you see it? What do you see happening if the United States does not rejoin the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, I mean, you have to deconstruct the question into many parts or components. From the Iranian part, they have made it clear that they gradually, step by step, they are going to go back from the agreement, and ultimately the agreement becomes utterly meaningless, because the Europeans are not prepared to stand up to the U.S., and the U.S. is not doing it properly.
They are not prepared to do that.
Yes, right. And Iranians will not continue. They have already done more than enough within the 5 years to remain to adhere to it. But now they have come up with a conclusion that it's not providing them with security and everything else that they were looking for. That's number one for the Iranians. So they step by step they would remove themselves from it. What they would do after that, it's still not clear. Certainly what is clear is that the tension and animosity within the region is going to increase, and you only need one spark before it leads to a huge crisis in the region. As far as United States goes, it has lost its credibility. And even the new administration, after talking so much about rejoining, and yes, we would do it and so on, allowed this opportunity to slip through its grip and hang, and simply because of that ideological position. I even, Rob, in a letter that I wrote to the president early on, from the Islamic Center, and I made it clear to him. I said, not only I pointed out to the critical role of 2015 for bringing peace to the region, and I even made it allowed a degree of space. I said, if your administration, people are around you, are not helping you, let us be the one who guide you through and to show you how you can do it and achieve peace in the region. Unfortunately, if United States is not prepared to do it, we will not see peace, because already every country that you mentioned early on, Rob, Afghanistan is hardening of the position. The Taliban are threatening the central government. Iraq, constant bombardment of the green zone, including American embassy, American military bases. Syria is the same thing. Now we're beginning to see more activities in both theaters, the northeast, northeast and northwest. Yemen is the same thing. And you name it. So we are not going to have peace in the region.
And the Israeli occupation getting crueler
even
and
worse.
Crueler by the day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole region. There's one more thing I want to add, Ibrahim. You know, in terms of what does the future have in store? So in terms of what the region looks like, I think both of us have sketched out what's likely to happen. But the other thing that's going to happen is the coming together. It's already started in quite quite a few steps have taken place between China, Russia, and Iran. That Iran can't look west anymore. Can't look west to the United States. Can't look west to Europe. And so that alliance, as that alliance is going to grow, and Iran's distance from us and from Europe is going to intensify even more than it is today.
Well,
yeah, I mean, all the military contracts that have been signed by China, Iran and China and Russia clearly indicates the direction that the Iranians are moving
to. Well, we're going to have to end it there, gentlemen.
All right.
Well, the music says it's time to end another dynamic discussion on the Middle East. And so I want to thank Rob Prince and Ibrahim Kazrouni for another fine evening of discussion and a perspective and analysis of Middle East issues not often heard in the corporate media. And so thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I hope
Thanks
we're wrong,
much.
But I don't think we are.
We all, yes, I know. I hear. We have to have some hope. And so, I want to thank